Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Thursday, February 19th reading of Newsmax. The report is Trump meets advisors on Iran as war threat grows. By Michael Katz. President Donald Trump met Wednesday with top advisors to evaluate strategy on Iran's nuclear program, as the U.S. expands its military footprint in the region amid rising tensions. The U.S. and Iran held a second round of talks on Tehran's nuclear program Tuesday in Geneva. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, White House Advisor Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and other senior officials attended Wednesday's meeting, Axios reported. One U.S. official told Axios that the Iranians need to come back to the Trump administration by the end of the month with a package of steps addressing concerns the U.S. presented in Geneva regarding their nuclear program. The Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, told Kushner and Witkoff a lot of positive things, but the devil is in the details, the official said. The ball is in Iran's court, so let's see. A second U.S. official expressed deep skepticism to Axios and said the talks in Geneva were a nothing burger. U.S. official told Axios that the arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford carrier strike group to the eastern Mediterranean in the coming days could factor into the timing of any potential military action against Iran. Rubio also is planning to visit Israel at the end of the month for talks about Iran, a U.S. official told Axios. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters Wednesday that there are many arguments one can make in favor of a strike against Iran. The president had a very successful operation as commander-in-chief with Operation Midnight Hammer, Leavitt said in a briefing that aired live on Newsmax and the free Newsmax 2 streaming platform. Totally obliterated Iran's nuclear facilities. The president has always been very clear with respect to Iran or any country around the world that diplomacy is his first option. Iran would be very wise to make a deal with President Trump and with this administration. He's talking to many people. Of course, his national security team first and foremost. This is something, obviously, the president takes seriously. He's always thinking about what is in the best interest of the United States of America, our military, the American people. That's how he makes decisions with respect to military action of any kind. Russia's Lavrov warns against any new U.S. strike on Iran. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in an interview made public on Wednesday, said that any new U.S. strike on Iran would have serious consequences and called for restraint to find a solution to enable Iran to pursue a peaceful nuclear program. Lavrov's interview with Saudi Arabia's Al Arabiya television was aired a day after U.S. and Iranian negotiators held indirect talks in Geneva to head off a new mounting crisis between Washington and Tehran. The consequences are not good. There have already been strikes on Iran on nuclear sites under the control of the International Atomic Energy Agency. From what we can judge, there were real risks of a nuclear incident, Lavrov said in the interview, which was posted on his ministry's website. I'm carefully watching reactions in the region from Arab countries, Gulf monarchies. No one wants an increase in tension. Everybody understands this is playing with fire. Boosting tensions, he said, could undo the positive steps of recent years, including improved relations between Iran and nearby countries, notably Saudi Arabia. A senior U.S. official told Reuters on Wednesday that Iran was expected to submit a written proposal on how to resolve its standoff with the United States after the talks in Geneva. U.S. national security advisors met in the White House on Wednesday and were told all U.S. military forces deployed to the region should be in place by mid-March, the official said. The United States wants Iran to give up its nuclear program, and Iran has adamantly refused and denied it is trying to develop an atomic weapon. Lavrov said Arab countries were sending signals to Washington, clearly calling for restraint and a search for an agreement that will not infringe on Iran's lawful rights and guarantee that Iran has a purely peaceful nuclear enrichment program. Russia, he said, remained in close, regular contact with Iran's leaders, and we have no reason to doubt that Iran sincerely wants to resolve this problem on the basis of observing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Major U.S. naval air buildup sets stage for potential Iran war. The massive U.S. military buildup in the Middle East, including warships, fighter jets, and refueling aircraft, lays the foundation for a potentially sustained campaign against Iran, should President Donald Trump give the order. Trump, he ordered strikes on Iran last year, has repeatedly threatened Tehran with further military action if ongoing talks do not reach a replacement for the nuclear deal the president tore up in 2018 during his first term in office. CNN and CBS reported Wednesday that the U.S. military will be ready to launch strikes against Iran as early as this weekend, though Trump has reportedly not made a final decision yet. The presence of so much firepower in the region creates a momentum of its own, said Susan Zida, senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Sometimes that momentum is a little hard to just put the brakes on and say, that's it, we're not doing anything, Zida said during a panel discussion Wednesday. Ships. Washington currently has 13 warships in the Middle East, one aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, 9 destroyers, and 3 littoral combat ships, with more on the way, according to a U.S. official. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, is currently in the Atlantic Ocean en route from the Caribbean to the Middle East after being ordered there by Trump earlier this month. It is accompanied by 3 destroyers. It is rare for there to be 2 U.S. aircraft carriers, which carry dozens of warplanes and are crewed by thousands of sailors, in the Middle East. The United States had 2 of the massive warships in the region in June last year when it targeted 3 Iranian nuclear sites during Israel's 12-day campaign of strikes on Iran. Aircraft. The United States has also sent a large fleet of aircraft to the Middle East, according to open-source intelligence accounts on X and flight-tracking website FlightTrader24. These include F-22 Raptor stealth fighter jets, F-15 and F-16 warplanes, and the KC-135 aerial refueling aircraft that are needed to sustain their operations. On Wednesday, Flight Radar 24 showed multiple KC-135s flying near or in the Middle East, as well as E-3 Sentry airborne, warning and control aircraft, and cargo planes operating in the region. Protests, threats, and talks. Trump ordered the Lincoln to the Middle East as Iran cracked down on protests that were initially driven by economic grievances, but which turned into a massive movement against the Islamic Republic. The clerical leadership that took power after the 1979 Islamic Revolution responded to the demonstrations with deadly force and has held on to power, with many opponents of the system looking to outside intervention as the most likely driver of change. Trump had repeatedly warned Iran that if it killed protesters, the United States would intervene militarily, and he encouraged Iranians to take over state institutions, saying help is on the way. He pulled back from ordering strikes last month, saying Tehran had halted more than 800 executions under pressure from Washington, but has since renewed threats against Iran. U.S. and Iranian officials held talks in Geneva on Tuesday, aimed at averting U.S. military intervention, with Iran saying afterward that they had agreed on guiding principles for a deal. But White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said Wednesday that while there was a little bit of progress made, the two sides are still very far apart on some issues. Leavitt also told journalists there are many reasons and arguments that one could make for a strike against Iran, adding, Iran would be very wise to make a deal. Patel says FBI uncovered Antifa funding sources by Jim Mishler. FBI Director Kash Patel said Wednesday that investigators have uncovered what he described as major funding streams tied to Antifa. The revelations signaled possible new enforcement action as the Bureau intensified scrutiny of left-wing violence, according to a report from the Washington Examiner. Speaking on the Dan Bongino show, Patel said the FBI under President Donald Trump has been conducting a financial investigation into how demonstrations linked to the loosely organized far-left movement are supported. These organizations don't operate alone or in silence, Patel said. They operate with a heavy, heavy stream of funding. And we started looking into it, and guess what? We found them. Patel did not identify specific donors, organizations, or financial mechanisms, but said more details could emerge in the coming months as the investigation continues. The FBI director said agents are examining whether funding has flowed through U.S.-based nonprofit groups, including some with tax-exempt status, as well as possible foreign sources. He emphasized that investigators are focused on tracing financial support tied to acts of violence and not constitutionally protected protest activity. Money doesn't lie, Patel said, describing the effort as a strategy of following the money to determine who may be underwriting unlawful conduct. Patel also pointed to prosecutions the Bureau has already brought that he said were connected to Antifa-related violence, including federal arrests and convictions tied to protest incidents in multiple states. He referenced the ongoing federal trial involving 9 defendants in Texas who are accused of ambushing and attempting to murder ICE personnel on July 4, 2025. Patel also cited a case from 2023 in Georgia surrounding the proposed Atlanta Public Safety Training Facility known as Cop City. The director said the FBI has elevated the issue internally by creating what he described as a dedicated program focused on identifying financial backers of protest-related violence. Tracking Antifa has become so important that the Bureau established additional resources to investigate the funding behind such activity, he said. Antifa has long been described by participants and many analysts as a decentralized movement rather than a formal organization, a distinction that has complicated past law enforcement efforts to pursue conspiracy-style cases. However, Patel points to Antifa organizational structures, including conferences and a national network for local chapters. Bongino criticized past FBI leadership under former Democratic presidents Barack Obama and Joe Biden for describing Antifa as an idea. He said it's not an idea when actual action follows the idea. In September 2025, Trump signed an executive order declaring Antifa a domestic terror organization after first raising the idea during his first term. Patel said the FBI's current approach relies on intelligence and financial investigations, similar to those used in other counterterrorism probes, but he did not announce new charges tied specifically to the alleged funding networks. Voter ID bill tops 50 votes, faces Senate filibuster, by Mark Swanson. The Save America Act, a Republican-backed bill requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote nationwide, has secured support from 50 senators, setting up a showdown over election integrity in the upper chamber. The legislation, endorsed by President Donald Trump, passed the House last week, but in the Senate it faces the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome a filibuster, meaning Democrats can block it unless Republicans find additional support. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, has pledged to bring the bill to the floor, but acknowledged that there are not even close to enough votes to eliminate the filibuster, despite Trump's call to scrap the rule. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, the bill's chief sponsor, has floated the idea of forcing Democrats into a talking filibuster, requiring them to hold the floor to delay the measure. Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, last weekend became the 50th Republican to back the bill after revisions addressed her concerns. The law is clear that in this country, only American citizens are eligible to vote in federal elections. In addition, having people provide an ID at the polls, just as they have to do before boarding an airplane, checking into a hotel, or buying an alcoholic beverage, is a simple reform that will improve the security of our federal elections and will help give people more confidence in the results, Collins said in a statement Saturday. The Save America Act would require individuals to present documentary proof of citizenship in person when registering to vote. It also mandates photo identification for voting, including for mail-in ballots, which would require a copy of an ID. Republicans hold 53 seats in the Senate and would need significant Democratic support to advance the measure, in part because not all Republicans have signed on. Senators Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska, and Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, have not endorsed the bill. Murkowski criticized what she called one-size-fits-all mandates from Washington. Lee framed the effort in stark terms. This is high-stakes legislation. Pass it and we save the republic. Don't pass it and we roll the dice. Trump has repeatedly urged lawmakers to pass the legislation and said last week that voter ID would be in place for November midterms with or without Congress. Hillary Clinton says GOP using Epstein probe to shield Trump, by Charlie McCarthy. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said House Republicans investigating the Epstein files are using her and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, to divert attention away from President Donald Trump's relationship with the late disgraced financier. In an interview with the BBC in Berlin, where she attended the annual World Forum, Clinton said she believed the renewed focus on her family is political. The House Oversight Committee, led by Chair James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, has demanded testimony from the Clintons as part of a broader inquiry into Jeffrey Epstein's political and financial network. The committee recently agreed to drop a planned contempt vote after the Clintons agreed to appear for a closed-door deposition. "Look at this shiny object. We're going to have the Clintons, even Hillary Clinton, who never met the guy," she told the BBC, while acknowledging she met Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell on a few occasions. Bill Clinton, who is mentioned in the files, has acknowledged knowing Epstein, but he said he cut off contact more than 20 years ago. Neither Bill Clinton nor Hillary Clinton has been accused of wrongdoing by Epstein's victims, and both have denied knowing about his sex trafficking. Trump, who is also mentioned in the files, has repeatedly denied wrongdoing and said he severed ties with Epstein decades ago. Asked about Hillary Clinton's accusations, Trump told the BBC he had nothing to hide, adding the Democrats were being pulled in by the scandal. Hillary Clinton is scheduled to testify on February 26, followed by Bill Clinton on February 27, a rare moment in congressional history. The last time a former president testified before a congressional panel was Gerald Ford in 1983. In her BBC interview, Hillary Clinton also accused the Trump administration of a cover-up over its handling of the Epstein files and urged officials to release more material. "Get the files out. They are slow walking it," Clinton said. The White House rejected the accusation, saying the administration had already released thousands of pages and had done more for the victims than Democrats ever have. Millions of pages of new documents tied to Epstein were made public earlier this month by the Department of Justice after Congress passed the Epstein File Transparency Act. However, the DOJ acknowledged that roughly 3 million pages were not released due to privacy concerns, including personal medical records, graphic depictions of child abuse, and other materials that could jeopardize investigations. The latest release has triggered bipartisan criticism that the government is still withholding key information. Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, who co-wrote the law, has urged the DOJ to release internal memos explaining past charging decisions involving Epstein and his associates. On social media earlier this month, Hillary Clinton echoed her BBC comments and accused Republicans of turning oversight into a distraction. In posts on X, she challenged Comer to hold a public hearing rather than a closed-door deposition. Epstein died in a New York jail cell in 2019 while awaiting trial on federal sex trafficking charges. Epstein, obsessed with the Vatican, conspired with Steve Bannon. Newly released documents from the Justice Department have cast fresh light on disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein's long-running fixation with the Catholic Church and his private exchanges with Steve Bannon, former advisor to President Donald Trump, about efforts to take down Pope Francis. The tranche of emails and text messages dating primarily from 2014 to 2019 reveals a pattern of mockery, ideological hostility, and political strategizing centered on the Vatican. Epstein was convicted in 2008 of child sex offenses and later died in federal custody in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. The records showed that in the years between those events, he remained engaged with powerful political and media figures, including Bannon, and expressed particular contempt for the Roman Catholic Church and its papacy. The most politically charged revelations involve text messages exchanged in 2018 and 2019 between Epstein and Bannon, the former White House chief strategist who had become an advisor to Epstein in the years after he was found guilty of sex charges. In June 2019 message, Bannon wrote to Epstein, "We'll take down Pope Francis, the Clintons, Chinese President Xi Jinping, Francis, EU. Come on, brother." The language suggests that Francis was viewed by Bannon as part of a broader set of geopolitical and ideological adversaries. At the time, Francis was a vocal critic of nationalism, xenophobia, and anti-immigrant policies, positions that placed him at odds with segments of the populist right and traditional Catholics. The exchanges occurred amid an intense period of conservative opposition to Francis, which included public criticism from Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano and disputes over the Pope's handling of clergy sexual abuse cases. Bannon's messages also reference the 2019 book In the Closet of the Vatican by French journalist Frédéric Martel, which alleged widespread secrecy about homosexuality within Vatican ranks. In texts, Bannon appeared to propose turning the book into a documentary film and suggested that Epstein serve as executive producer. "You are now ex-exec producer of ITCOTV, Bannon wrote, using an abbreviation of the book's title. Martel later stated publicly that he declined Bannon's overtures and that his publishers controlled the film rights. He told reporters he believed Bannon sought to instrumentalize the book in a campaign against Francis. In another exchange, Epstein forwarded Bannon an article titled, "Pope Francis or Steve Bannon? Catholics Must Choose," to which Bannon replied, "Easy choice." Epstein's responses occasionally veered into literary provocation. After Bannon shared an article about the Vatican condemning populist nationalism, Epstein quoted John Milton's Paradise Lost, "Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." the Reverend Antonio Spadaro, a close collaborator of Pope Francis, told CNN that the messages reveal a desire to fuse spiritual authority with political power for strategic ends, something Francis consistently resisted. Among the most striking documents are emails sent by Epstein during Francis's September 2015 visit to the United States. As Francis met with then-President Barack Obama, addressed Congress and the United Nations, and celebrated Mass at Madison Square Garden, Epstein exchanged messages with his brother Mark Epstein about the Pope's presence in New York. In one email, dated September 23, 2015, Epstein suggested inviting Francis for a massage, followed by a lewd and sacrilegious joke about the Pope sexually climaxing while invoking the name of Jesus. The crude remarks, riddled with typos and symbols, were sent 7 years after the Epstein's Florida conviction. Church observers cited in reaction to the documents say the tone of the emails reflect more than tasteless humor. Christopher Hale, a former Obama staffer and Catholic commentator, wrote that Epstein's words express contempt for Francis, for the papacy, and for moral authority the Pope represented. The email shows that Epstein was aware the Pope was staying near his Upper East Side residence during the New York leg of the visit. "You should invite him over for an egg cream and exchange stories," Mark Epstein wrote in one message. Jeffrey Epstein's response escalated into the vulgar suggestion. Beyond the 2015 emails, the DOJ documents reveal Jeffrey Epstein's deeper interest in Vatican politics and history. Despite not being a Catholic, he reportedly read papal biographies and Catholic texts, showing familiarity with books about Vatican finances, including investigations into the 1982 Banco Ambrosino scandal, and maintained relationships with individuals critical of Francis. On August 6, 1982, the Italian Treasury Minister announced the liquidation of the Banco Ambrosiano after the murder of Roberto Calvi, the former president of the bank. The scandal gave rise to many conspiracy theories. Jeffrey Epstein also posed in a photograph with Ghislaine Maxwell alongside Pope John Paul II years earlier, underscoring his access to elite circles that intersected with church leadership. In separate correspondence from 2014, an Italian cybersecurity researcher discussed blockchain and digital currency experimentation with Jeffrey Epstein, referencing small sovereign states such as Vatican City as potentially viable environments for financial innovation. An FBI report included in the release references claims that an associate described as Epstein's hacker may have possessed a Vatican passport, though those claims remain unverified. Jeffrey Epstein's private commentary also touched on Catholic doctrine. In a 2013 email criticizing the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's philanthropic philosophy that every life has equal value, Jeffrey Epstein dismissed the sentiment as Catholicism at its worst, signaling disdain for core teachings about the sanctity and equal dignity of human life. Francis died in April 2025 at age 88. His successor, Pope Leo XIV, has continued to emphasize the Church's distance from nationalist politics. Jeffrey Epstein died in Manhattan jail in August 2019. Maxwell is serving a 20-year sentence for her role in his trafficking operation. Steve Bannon, close to Epstein, backed Trump removal. Newly released Justice Department files shed fresh light on former Donald Trump strategist Steve Bannon's private communications with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The files reveal discussions about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove then-President Trump and efforts by Bannon to advise Epstein as Epstein faced renewed legal scrutiny. The documents, which include text messages and emails from late 2017, through Epstein's arrest in July 2019 show that Bannon, a prominent figure in the MAGA movement and former White House chief strategist, maintained a close and at times supportive relationship with Epstein. The files also show that the relationship continued long after Epstein's 2008 conviction for soliciting a minor for prostitution. One of the most explosive exchanges occurred in a text conversation beginning on New Year's Eve 2018, shortly after Democrats regained control of the House of Representatives. According to the messages, Bannon said that the White House, widely understood to mean the White House, had zero plan to punch back amid mounting political pressure. Epstein responded, referring to Trump, "He is really borderline, not sure what he may do." Bannon replied, "I think it's beyond borderline, 25th Amendment," referring to the constitutional provision that allows a vice president and a majority of the cabinet to remove a president deemed unfit for office. In another part of the exchange, Bannon wrote that we really need an intervention regarding Trump. The disclosure of those texts has triggered backlash from some conservatives. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn wrote on X that if Bannon and Epstein were behind it, Bannon needs to be brought in for questioning. Even former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, echoed those concerns, writing that there was no excuse for having such a friendly relationship with Epstein post-conviction, 2018 to 19, none. Representative Mace demands CIA release Epstein files by Jim Mishler. Representative Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, is calling on the CIA to turn over all records related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and convicted co-conspirator Ghislaine Maxwell, saying Congress and the public deserve full transparency about any potential ties. In a Tuesday letter to CIA Director John L. Ratcliffe, Mace wrote, "We write to request the opportunity to view any and all records, documents, images, video, photographs, communications, passports, and other material in the possession of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, related to Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and any of their activities." In a post accompanying the letter, Mace said, "Congress needs to know what, if any, relationship the CIA had with Jeffrey Epstein and what information they're sitting on. Classified or not, we want to see it," she added. "The American people deserve answers about whether our intelligence agencies had connections to a child sex trafficker." The letter cites prior Department of Justice filings showing that in 2011, attorneys for Epstein submitted a Freedom of Information Act request seeking records of any affiliation with the CIA. While the agency said at the time it could not locate information reflecting an acknowledged affiliation, it also stated that it could neither confirm nor deny the existence or non-existence of responsive records concerning a classified connection. Mace wrote that even acknowledging whether such records exist was deemed classified. She cited reported references to SCIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility used to handle classified material, and a 2015 email, which Epstein wrote, "It looks like a CIA drop." The letter also references Epstein's associations with people connected to the CIA's Iran-Contra era activities and his contact with former CIA Director William Burns and other foreign officials. At a minimum, Mace wrote, the CIA's National Resources Division would likely have had extensive contact with Epstein over the years, given its focus on high-level business figures who travel internationally. "We respectfully request the CIA search all records, classified and unclassified," she wrote, "and make them available for congressional review and, to the maximum extent allowable by law, to the public. The American people and the survivors of Epstein's heinous crimes deserve complete transparency," Mace wrote. The DOJ recently released its largest batch yet of Epstein files under the Epstein Files Transparency Act. It published more than 3 million pages of documents, over 2,000 videos, and 180,000 images that had previously been withheld, making it one of the most extensive public disclosures tied to the case. The release was described by DOJ as compliance with the law requiring disclosure of records related to Epstein and Maxwell, and includes correspondence and investigative material with high-profile names and contacts. FCC Chair Carr denies censoring Colbert interview. The chair of the Federal Communication Commission Wednesday denied the government had censored CBS late-night show Stephen Colbert from airing a candidate interview and confirmed that the agency is investigating ABC's The View. FCC Chair Brendan Carr confirmed that the FCC had opened an enforcement into whether the ABC daytime talk show violated equal time rules for interviews with political candidates. Colbert said Monday that the network lawyers barred him from airing an interview with Democratic Texas State Representative James Tallarico, who's running for his party's nomination for the U.S. Senate. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert was reportedly not prohibited from airing an interview with Tallarico, but was advised the broadcast could violate Federal Communication Commission equal time rules. Colbert kept pushing back against CBS Tuesday, taking a copy of the network's statement, wrapping it in a dog poop bag, and tossing it away. Colbert then ran his Tallarico interview on YouTube instead and told viewers why he couldn't show it on CBS. The FCC issued new guidance on January that said daytime and late-night talk shows were not exempt from equal time rules for candidate interviews. No breakthrough in Russia-Ukraine talks. The latest U.S. brokered talks between envoys from Moscow and Kyiv over Russia's all-out invasion of Ukraine ended Wednesday with no sign of a breakthrough and with both sides saying the talks were difficult as the war's fourth anniversary approaches next week. The negotiations in Switzerland were the third round of direct talks organized by the U.S. after meetings earlier this year in Abu Dhabi that officials described as constructive, but which also made no major headway. Expectations for significant progress in Geneva were low. The negotiations were not easy, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said after the talks broke up and he spoke briefly by phone from Kiev with his negotiating team. He earlier accused Russia of trying to drag out negotiations while it presses on with its invasion, an accusation he and European leaders have repeatedly made in the past. Despite that, some progress was made on military issues, although political differences remain deep, including over the future of land in eastern Ukraine that is occupied by the Russian army, and that Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to keep, Zelensky said. The head of the Russian delegation, Putin advisor Vladimir Medensky, told reporters that the 2 days of talks in Geneva were difficult but businesslike. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that it's too early to speak about the outcome of the talks. Putin has been receiving reports about progress in Geneva, he said. Both sides said a new round of talks is set to take place. Zelensky described the military discussions as constructive, adding that the armed forces of both countries considered how any future ceasefire might be monitored. Monitoring will definitely be carried out with participation of the American side, he said in a voice message shared in a media group chat on WhatsApp. U.S. President Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, said on social media that Washington's push for peace in Ukraine over the past year has brought about meaningful progress, without elaborating. The two armies remained locked in battle on a roughly 1,250-kilometer, 750-mile front line, while Russia bombards civilian areas of Ukraine daily. Hours after the first day of talks ended on Tuesday, Russian drones killed a woman and injured a 6-year-old girl and an 18-month-old toddler in the southern Ukraine city of Zaporizhia, officials said. Overnight, Russia launched one ballistic missile and 126 long-range drones at Ukraine, according to the Ukrainian Air Force. Zelensky said that the Ukrainian and American envoys in Geneva met with representatives from the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. Europe's participation in the process is indispensable, Zelensky said. European leaders, mindful of Putin's wider ambitions, say their own security is at stake in Ukraine, having insisted on being consulted in peace efforts. Russia and Ukraine appear to still be far apart on their demands for a settlement. Zelensky has offered a ceasefire and a face-to-face meeting with Putin, but Moscow wants a comprehensive agreement before committing to a truce. Putin's key goals remain what he declared when Russia invaded its neighbor on February 24, 2022. Ukraine must renounce joining NATO, sharply reduce the size of its army, and protect Russian language and culture to keep the country in Moscow's orbit. Additionally, Putin wants Kiev to withdraw its forces from the four eastern regions Moscow has occupied but doesn't fully control. Zelensky says Ukraine won't surrender land to Russia. U.S. pulling all troops from Syria as Iran tensions rise, by James Morley III. The United States is withdrawing all of its roughly 1,000 troops from Syria, ending a decade-long military presence focused on combating the Islamic State group, according to American officials cited by the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday. The withdrawal, already completed at several strategic outposts in northeastern Syria and along the Syria-Jordan-Iraq border, is expected to be completed within 2 months. Officials described the move as conditions-based, signaling that the U.S. could reconsider if the Islamic State group regains strength. The decision follows major shifts in Syria. President Ahmad al-Shirah's forces recently seized most Kurdish-held territory, and the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, Washington's primary partner against ISIS for years, have agreed to integrate into the Syrian army under a U.S.-backed ceasefire. Some U.S. and foreign officials have expressed concern that a reduced American presence could create space for an ISIS resurgence or embolden Damascus to abandon its ceasefire commitments. Others noted the remaining U.S. contingent had become more of a political symbol of support than a decisive counterterrorism force. The drawdown comes amid rising tensions across the Middle East as the United States has moved significant naval and air assets into the region in preparation for potential strikes on Iran if negotiations regarding Tehran's nuclear program collapse. Iran has warned it would retaliate against American forces if attacked. The U.S. has assembled a carrier strike group off Iran's coast and is deploying a second aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, to the region. A senior U.S. administration official told The Hill on Wednesday that some U.S. personnel are leaving Syria as part of a deliberate and conditions-based transition. U.S. forces remain poised to respond to any ISIS threats that arise in the region as we support partner-led efforts to prevent the terrorist network's resurgence, the official said, adding that a U.S. presence at scale is no longer necessary given the Syrian government's stated willingness to combat terrorist threats. President Trump is committed to supporting a Syria that is stable, unified, and at peace with itself and its neighbors, the official added. This is a key element of the president's vision for a peaceful and prosperous Middle East. Air Force One will be painted red, white, and blue, as Trump has hinted. A red, white, and blue color scheme championed by President Donald Trump will become the new look for Air Force One, the U.S. military has said. The Air Force said a red, white, gold, and dark blue paint scheme will be used for the updated jet that is slated to serve as Air Force One, as well as other smaller jets that routinely fly other top government officials. The military released a rendering of the new look that matches an airplane model that has been seen in the Oval Office for meetings with foreign leaders. Boeing is in the process of modifying two of its 747-800 aircraft that are slated to replace the existing fleet of two aging Boeing 747-200 aircraft that the president currently uses and that take on the Air Force One call sign when the president is aboard. In 2018, Trump directed that those new jets would ditch the iconic Kennedy-era blue and white design for a white and navy color scheme. Instead, the top half of the plane would have been white, while the bottom, including the belly, would have been dark blue. A streak of dark red would have run from the cockpit to the tail. The coloring was almost identical to the exterior of Trump's personal plane. An Air Force review had suggested the darker colors would increase costs and delay delivery of the new jumbo jets, and President Joe Biden reversed the decision in March 2023. Trump told reporters last month, "We want power blue, not baby blue," referring to the current color of the aircraft. "Everything has its time and place. We'll be changing the colors," Trump added. The Air Force's statement says a third 747-8i Boeing jet will be painted in the same colors. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth formally accepted a luxury Boeing 747 jet from Qatar last May for use as Air Force One, despite questions among some administration critics about the ethics and legality of taking the expensive gift from a foreign nation. Air Force Secretary Troy Menk told lawmakers last June that the security modifications to the jet would cost less than $400 million, but provided no details. Zuckerberg denies Meta intentionally addicts minors. Mark Zuckerberg and opposing lawyers dueled in a Los Angeles courtroom Wednesday, where the Meta CEO answered questions about young people's use of Instagram, his congressional testimony, and internal advice he's received about being authentic and not robotic. Zuckerberg's testimony is part of an unprecedented social media trial that questions whether Meta's platforms deliberately addict and harm children. Attorneys representing the plaintiff, a now 20-year-old woman identified by the initials KGM, claim her early use of social media addicted her to the technology and exacerbated depression and suicidal thoughts. Meta Platforms and Google's YouTube are the two remaining defendants in the case, which TikTok and Snap have settled. Beginning his questioning, the plaintiff's attorney, Mark Lanier, laid out three options of what people can do regarding vulnerable people: help them, ignore them, or prey upon them and use them for our own ends. Zuckerberg said he agrees the last option is not what a reasonable company should do, saying, "I think a reasonable company should try to help the people that uses its services." When pressed on past internal goals aimed at increasing the amount of time users spent on Meta's platforms, Zuckerberg said the company no longer relies on those metrics, arguing they are not the best measures of success. The Meta CEO emphasized that company policy prohibits children under 13 from using its platforms and said accounts belonging to underage users are removed when identified. Zuckerberg denied that features such as infinite scroll and autoplay were intentionally designed to be addictive and defended Meta's efforts to improve user safety. When he was asked about his compensation, Zuckerberg said he had pledged to give almost all of his money to charity, focusing on scientific research. Lanier asked him how much money he has pledged to victims impacted by social media, to which Zuckerberg replied, "I disagree with the characterization of your question." Lanier also asked Zuckerberg about what he characterized as extensive media training, including for testimonies like the one he was giving in court. Lanier pointed to an internal document about feedback on Zuckerberg's tone of voice on his own social media, imploring him to come off as authentic, direct, human, insightful, and real, and instructing him not to try hard, fake, robotic, corporate, or cheesy in his communication. Zuckerberg pushed back against the idea that he's been coached on how to respond to questions or present himself, saying those offering the advice were just giving feedback. Regarding his media appearances and public speaking, Zuckerberg said, "I think I'm actually well known to be sort of bad at this." The Meta CEO has long been mocked online for appearing robotic, and when he was younger, nervous when speaking publicly. In 2010, during an interview with renowned tech journalists Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg, he was sweating so profusely that Swisher asked him if he wanted to take off the hoodie that was his uniform at the time. Lanier spent a considerable stretch of his limited time with Zuckerberg asking about the company's age verification policies. "I don't see why this is so complicated," Zuckerberg said after a lengthy back and forth, reiterating that the company's policy restricts users under the age of 13 and that they work to detect users who have lied about their ages to bypass restrictions. Zuckerberg mostly stuck to his talking points, referencing his goal of building a platform that is valuable to users, and on multiple occasions saying he disagreed with Lanier's characterization of his questions or of Zuckerberg's own comments. Zuckerberg has testified in other trials and answered questions from Congress about youth safety on Meta's platforms, and he apologized to families at that hearing whose lives had been upended by tragedies they believed were because of social media. This trial, though, marks the first time Zuckerberg will answer similar questions in front of a jury, and again, bereaved parents are expected to be in the limited courtroom seats available to the public. The case, along with two others, has been selected as a bellwether trial, meaning its outcome could impact how thousands of similar lawsuits against social media companies are likely to play out. A Meta spokesperson said the company strongly disagrees with the allegations in the lawsuit and said they are confident the evidence will show our long-standing commitment to supporting young people. One of Meta's attorneys, Paul Schmidt, said in his opening statement that the company is not disputing that KGM experienced mental health struggles, but rather disputing that Instagram played a substantial factor in those struggles. Schmidt pointed to medical records that showed a turbulent home life, and both he and an attorney representing YouTube argue she turned to their platforms as a coping mechanism or a means of escaping her mental health struggles. Zuckerberg's testimony comes a week after that of Adam Mosseri, the head of Meta's Instagram, who said in the courtroom that he disagrees with the idea that people can be clinically addicted to social media platforms. Mosseri maintained that Instagram works hard to protect young people using the service and said it's not good for the company over the long run to make decisions that profit for us but are poor for people's well-being. Much of Mosseri's questioning from the plaintiff's lawyer, Mark Lanier, centered on cosmetic filters on Instagram that changed people's appearance, a topic that Lanier is sure to revisit with Zuckerberg. He is also expected to face questions about Instagram's algorithm, the infinite nature of Meta's feeds, and other features the plaintiffs argue are designed to get users hooked. Meta is also facing a separate trial in New Mexico that began last week. Exercise Lowers Risk of Dying from Cancer by Lynn C. Allison. Cancer survival rates continue to improve, with about 70% of patients now reaching the 5-year survival mark. New research suggests that regular exercise may further boost those odds. While numerous studies have shown that physical activity increases longevity in heart patients, emerging evidence indicates that people diagnosed with cancer, or those in remission, may also extend their lives by incorporating strength training, other forms of exercise, into their daily routines. A study published in the journal Nutrition, Obesity, and Exercise analyzed data from more than 17,000 survivors of common cancers, including bladder, oral, ovarian, and rectal cancers. Researchers found that regular exercise was linked to a lower risk of dying from the disease. Physical activity has a significant benefit to cancer patients at any stage in their cancer journey. Dr. Susan Maltzer, director of the Centers of the Cancer Rehabilitation Program at Northwell Health, told the New York Post, "We know that before they start treatment, during treatment, after treatment, and for life, physical activity and exercise have a significant impact, not just in their well-being, but a lot of times in their cancer trajectory," she said. Maltzer explained that exercise has anti-inflammatory effects that influence the body's biochemical processes and cell signaling pathways. Physical activity can also help rebuild muscle mass lost during cancer treatment. For example, breast cancer patients may experience limited shoulder mobility as a result of surgery or therapy. Exercise can help restore function. Maintaining a healthy weight may also reduce the risk of recurrence in certain breast cancers because fat tissue produces estrogen. "These are some breast cancers that feed off estrogen," she said. So keeping your body lean is important. Maltzer emphasized that it's never too late to begin exercising and regain strength. "The body is a remarkable thing," Maltzer said. "It's never too late." And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.